Questo podcast è stato realizzato nell'ambito del progetto PRIN 2020 REACT.
Thank you very much for this introduction. I wanted to start by thanking Professor Anand for inviting me here. I studied here, as was mentioned earlier, so it's also a great honor, more personal and emotional level. So today I'm going to be looking at selected aspects. It's impossible to cover everything, although I will be giving an overview of the problems associated with the asylum plan that has been signed by the UK with Rwanda. And I will cover two dimensions of legality. So I will be looking at the interpretation of lawfulness as for the High Court of England and Wales, a narrow interpretation of international law and international human rights law. And then I'm going to examine the legality of the plan from an international human rights and European human rights perspective, including the EU, you know, particularly since the entry into force of the EU Charter. And earlier, Professor Daniele was talking about Brexit. There are also elements here about Brexit that are relevant, because one of the arguments, as I will touch upon, I won't be able to explain in detail, but one of the arguments that was made by the claimants was that there was also a violation of EU retained law. So for those who are not maybe familiar with this concept, under the EU Withdrawal Act 2018, which was then amended in 2020, there is section 6 which details what the UK wants to keep, wants to preserve of EU law. And so one of the arguments made by the claimants was that the Asylum Procedures Directive, the first one, so the original 2005 directive, had been breached by the Home Office. And that didn't succeed. So I will explain why briefly. But in the appeal, one of the grounds is again that there's been a breach of EU retained legislation. My view is that that argument will not succeed again, partly because at the moment there is a bill which so the Brexiteers call the Brexit Freedoms Bill, which is the revocation and repeal EU retained law, very long title, but they basically want to scrap everything that's left of EU law in the domestic legal system. And so my view, my take is that even the Court of Appeal will not challenge that argument. Partly because there's also another act, which I will mention, which arguably does repeal, you know, that bit of EU law from the domestic legal system. So there are a lot of different interconnected aspects in this judgment, which make it interesting to examine, besides the legality under international law. You know, there's sort of an interconnection between domestic legislation and then the interplay with international law. So this is what I'm going to be looking at. I'm going to start off by focusing on the purported aim of the agreement, and even there, when we talk about agreement, I will stop there and focus on the fact that it's not really an agreement under international law. And I will already start highlighting some of the problems, the concerns that many immigration human rights lawyers have already highlighted, without even considering, the Geneva Convention and the European Convention of Human Rights, because there are issues also in terms of the rule of law at national level. Most blatantly, the lack of parliamentary scrutiny, which is also one of the reasons why they chose a memorandum of understanding, as I will explain shortly. I will then look not necessarily in this order, but I will be looking at what the problems are, what they could be potentially, in my view, under international refugee and human rights law. Some have already been discussed and examined in much detail by scholars and practitioners. And I will be looking at the decision of the High Court, of the Divisional Court specifically. And then I will conclude with some thoughts for reflection, and then we shall open the floor for some questions or debate. So I wanted to start at the macro level with some very bold statements on the part of the government. So specifically, we're talking about the Johnson government, and at the time, the Home Secretary was Priti Patel. This plan in particular should be seen in the context of a package of measures that the UK launched in March 2021. So they launched the so-called new plan on immigration, and another very much discussed and controversial piece of, this time legally binding, legislation is the NOW Act, the Illegal Migration Act. It has passed in spite of all the opposition, resistance from all quarters. So it's not sort of a one-sided view. You know, everyone has criticized that act, including more recently the Archbishop of Canterbury. So all of these pieces of legislation, whether soft law or hard law, have been subject to much criticism. But it's part at domestic level of a growing trend of trying to avoid parliamentary scrutiny. So anyone who is familiar with the various constitutional acts related to Brexit might know that they have inserted so-called Henry VIII powers. These are special clauses which allow ministers to go ahead with measures without having to submit them to Parliament first. Sometimes they've been successful, other times the House of Lords, which is always sort of fighting against the House of Commons, because we know that often there's a disagreement between the two houses, mainly because House of Commons is really the more democratic, if you want, branch of the British Parliament, and reflect therefore the views of the government as well. But my point being is that this action plan is a trend at domestic level of trying to keep Parliament out and not allowing it to scrutinize measures that they want to adopt. And in fact, it's happened. And so I wanted to start off with this statement from the Home Office, among other things. At the time, Johnson said, and Patel repeated that, that with this plan, they would create, and perhaps I should have highlighted it as well, a safe environment for migrants to be able to start a new life in relation to all aspects of someone's well-being and livelihood, education, employment and accommodation. I wanted to contrast this with what the Law Society of England and Wales has said. They have been critical from day one, and I've used this to because it sort of captures the main problems. One, it's not legally binding, so no accountability, no scrutiny of Parliament. And most importantly, from the perspective of human rights, it doesn't afford any kind of protection to asylum seekers. So what happens is that, as I will explain shortly, if an asylum claim is found to be inadmissible, they can be sent not just to Rwanda. I mean, this is a plan with Rwanda, but if you look carefully at the provisions, they can be sent to any other country which is deemed to be a safe third country. which some of you might know has always been controversial. But particularly in relation to Rwanda, it doesn't really seem to reflect the reality on the ground for Rwanda's very poor human rights record. Also specifically in relation to specific protected characteristics under the Geneva Convention. And so I use this sort of as a way to then proceed to the analysis of this plan. So starting off again, sort of macro, then going down to the micro level. So that's the full title. And again, I think it's important to stress that it's not just migration, but it's economic development. Why am I stressing that? Because there's a quid pro quo here. So Rwanda will do it because in exchange, they are receiving a lot of money in terms of financial aid and also help for Rwandans in the UK to integrate. So that is the quid pro quo. And also the other reason why I'm stressing that is because the High Court used that as an argument to claim that the plan is lawful, because the High Court says, well, that's an incentive. So Rwanda will not breach the Refugee Convention because they get a lot of money. So they have an incentive to comply with the Refugee Convention, which I think, coming from a court, is a bit, I think, disconcerting. So rather than focusing, well, what does the Refugee Convention, you know, what does the plan say? Is the plan in line with the convention? No, the starting point is they get a lot of money, so they will comply. So I think that is the first point to, I think, make against this judgment. But the starting point is that the, as I said earlier, the memorandum, as I'm sure you will all know, is not legally binding. It's become a common trend. You know, we could mention the one that Italy signed with Libya, for example, so we know the advantages of signing a memorandum of understanding. The House of Lords, the International Agreements Committee, in fact, has issued a report where it really has criticized that extensively. In fact, the report focuses 80% on that issue, and you know, for various reasons, also, as I said, from a domestic point of view, not just at international level. But as I say here, the Memorandum of Understanding, even though it's soft law, it reflects a change. So I said earlier it's part of a package of an immigration plan. And the other measure, legislative measure, is this new Nationality and Borders Act 2022, which in one particular section, section 16, incorporates some of the immigration rules, and in particular 345. This Act and these immigration rules already foresaw the possibility of declaring an asylum claim inadmissible in order to deport to a safe third country, but there wasn't a bilateral agreement. And so this plan is helpful, you know, it helps the government go ahead with what they've been meaning to do. So I think that's an important point. But cleverly, as I said, through soft law measures so that they don't have to go through parliamentary scrutiny. I'll touch upon that in a moment. So as I have been sort of referring to, the main aim of this plan is to allow the Home Office to declare asylum claims in a rather expedited manner. And in fact, even the appeal process has either been severely reduced, if not removed. Those who are subject to a deportation order have, depending on their situation, for example, if they're already in immigration detention, they even have something like only a week. Otherwise, you know, 2 weeks. So not much time. So already we can see that there are problems there in terms of the right to a fair trial, the right to be heard, That's something, in fact, that I included in the other slide. So what happens is that, as I explained briefly here, there's a two-stage process. So the first one is to be able for the Home Secretary to declare an asylum application inadmissible. When does that happen? Basically, when there is evidence that the asylum seeker has entered the UK through what they define as a dangerous journey. And they explicitly give the example, unsurprisingly, of people arriving to the UK with small boats, you know, through the Channel, you know, from France to Dover, you know, from Calais to Dover, or in lorries, right, hidden in lorries. Or in instances where they've gone through other countries and maybe one of them was a safe third country, they should have applied for asylum then. They shouldn't have tried to enter the UK. And I should stress, to enter irregularly, right? Illegally, because that's the whole point of trying to stop what the UK defines as irregular migrants without really distinguishing. What matters, the real concern to the government is that you are irregular. and we know the evidence tells us that, sadly, you know, most people enter irregularly or illegally purely because of factual circumstances in which they find themselves, not because they want to. So the so-called direct route that the UK refers to, for example, applying for a humanitarian visa or family reunification or specific resettlement schemes, think about Afghanistan or Hong Kong more recently, Ukraine, you know, those are very clear-cut, rare, I would say, circumstances. And instead, the UK government seems to suggest everyone should try to go for that route. And also, this idea that if you're really in need, you wouldn't pay smugglers, you know, thousands of dollars. You know, if you have all that amount of money, well, that's the argument that, you know, if you read some of the you know, documentation of the Home Office, even the interviews that they released, you know, to the BBC, you know, they. That is the kind of approach, right, that they seem to just, no, they're not really in need, and most of them are economic migrants, they're not really people fleeing persecution. So there's clearly a lot of bias to start with, and the legislation is just a reflection of this embedded bias. There are exemptions, as I say here, so unaccompanied children, Rwandans, because otherwise that would be a blatant breach of non-refoulement, so Rwandans cannot be returned to Rwanda, EU nationals, and on paper families, but the argument I'm making here is that I mentioned bias before. So if you, again, if you look through the documentation, informal documentation of the Home Office, again, there's this biased approach suggesting that it's normally single men who try to cross the channel, so references always to small boats, migrants, and that doesn't take into account, say, even if it were true, and again, there's no empirical evidence to suggest that, but say we even accepted that, how can the government not see that it would have implications on other people? So there might be other family members already in the UK, for example, or sometimes there might be other members of the family that would then join. So there are implications on the family. So even though on paper they argue that they are exempted, in the real world there would be an impact. And we also know that unaccompanied children, there's a lot of problems in terms of credibility. So a lot of times minors are their claims are rejected purely because they don't look like minors, right? They're, as I said, a lot of these decisions are made summarily in a very expedited manner. So on the ground we know that the reality is different. So that's something that I'm going to be looking at. Now, starting off with some first concerns. So the first point is the fact that, so going back to the legislation, it distinguishes between asylum seekers who enter the UK directly, so lawfully, in comparison to those who enter the UK irregularly. Still, their claim is not considered inadmissible, so the Home Office has to determine their status, but because they entered irregularly, they're treated differently. So there's an issue there of discrimination, right? So those who enter regularly will have full refugee status, they will have a right of abode, and then all the rights that are attached to refugees when they are successful with their claim. Instead, if they enter irregularly, they only get temporary status, and they are excluded from access to some rights. And so even this discriminatory treatment or differential treatment is highly problematic. So it really is in stark contrast with what the government has been saying, right? The story that they are presenting is that they want to make people's lives better, they want to create a safe environment. But when we look at the provisions of, as I said, the Nationality and Borders Act, well, we already find discriminatory treatment. So it raises issues of credibility of the real aim, and we know what the real aim. The real aim is to keep them out, and to even if they maybe don't manage to do so, they hope that with this legislation, right, with this legislation and the memorandum of understanding, that it acts. All these measures taken together act as a deterrent. Right, so people think twice before trying to enter the UK. But what is problematic, other aspects, is that the standard of proof has been raised. So here we're looking at domestic legislation. So to prove that you really have fear of being persecuted, now it's based on the balance of probabilities, which is harder. It's a much higher threshold, rather than what used to be the reasonable likelihood threshold. In terms of the crime threshold, even this time it has been lowered. So if you have been sentenced to, before it was 2 years imprisonment, now it's 1 year imprisonment. The other concern, which I mentioned earlier, is the fact that it's made life really difficult in relation to appealing against a decision. So that is another worry, even from an international human rights perspective. Another area of concern is the fact that they have to hurry up in submitting the evidence. So they get penalized if they don't submit the evidence in due course. And this, we know, again, doesn't really reflect the difficulty that someone in that situation is in, and how difficult it is to provide evidence. I mean, they have nothing. And besides the difficulty also of the language, and as I said earlier, the lack of credibility. There's a lot of bias, you know, depending which part of the world you come from. You know, maybe you come from a country where, I don't know, statistically it's economic migrants. Okay, no, so you can't possibly be an asylum seeker. And so they ditched their claim purely on the basis of where they're from. They don't even make an ad hoc assessment of that particular individual claim. And that was already happening before, so just imagine now. They've been given carte blanche to basically carry on, if not to push this further. But what is even more worrying is that there's also an attack on the rule of law, as I said. So you know, this goes to 0.5 here. So it is now possible for tribunals to impose fines against solicitors, so defending or following the case of an asylum seeker for improper, unreasonable, or negligent behavior. And I think this is really dangerous. So together with the fact that there's been a weakening of the level, the standard of protection of asylum seekers' human rights, and when I say that, both substantive and procedurally, and obviously they go hand in hand, but they're not even given the possibility, right, of trying to make a claim, and then even if they do, life is very hard for them. So I think this is a big concern, the fact that there's an attack on solicitors, together with other aspects which concern the domestic legal system, such as cuts in legal aid. And so that again makes it even harder for asylum seekers to receive decent levels of counselling and representation. So here I've jotted down what I think are the areas of major concern, not that there aren't others, but the first one necessarily has to be the form, the type of legal instrument, which I've been touching upon. And I mentioned earlier that there's this report of the House of Lords, and this is of the International Agreements Committee, and I recommend reading it because it neatly outlines what the concerns are. Also because they launched an inquiry, there's, you know, many NGOs, practitioners, academics have submitted written evidences to say, and also the UN Refugee Agency, to really condemn the use of this instrument, the fact that it's a memorandum of understanding. From a constitutional law perspective, the concern is obviously the lack of parliamentary scrutiny, because they've been very clever. Not only is it obvious under international law that it's difficult to subject that to scrutiny, but they also inserted a specific clause where they say that the parties agree that it's not intended to be binding under international law. So this is a clever way of making sure that it can't be challenged, even though, you know, the International Law Commission does refer to use cogens and ways of trying to challenge it, but then in practice it does remain very difficult. But from a domestic point of view, just to stress that by doing that, by inserting this clause, then it excludes the possibility for Parliament under the Constitutional Reform and Governance Act 2010. So, you know, again, getting Parliament out of the way. So there are rule of law implications at a domestic level. So clearly it's a political arrangement, and that's what the parties intended to do. And it goes also against the guidance of the Commonwealth Foreign and Development Office, which has said that these type of instruments, like the Memorandum of Understanding, should not be used for areas where there are human rights implications. It should only be used in areas of technical relevance or administrative matters, technological matters, but certainly not human rights. And in fact, it's not surprising that the UN Refugee Agency has said that it goes against both the letter and the spirit of the UN Refugee Convention. And here I've outlined some of the most obvious areas of concern, so non-refoulement, which can be linked with the issue of Rwanda being a safe third country. I've included, I think there's a nice definition in the recast Asylum Procedures Directive of the EU, where it really touches upon all the various principles that need to be respected and fundamental rights, obviously including the principle of non-refoulement, but there's also reference to other principles that need to be ensured for a country to be considered as a safe country. And so clearly, if we read the reports, and these are recent reports, as you can see, you know, 2022, of both Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, they both refer to a very poor human rights record of Rwanda. In particular, the one by Human Rights Watch refers to extrajudicial killings, persecutions to those of certain protected characteristics, such as religious beliefs, just to mention one. So it's not quite clear where the UK found, established, that Rwanda is a safe third country, without even considering that, you know, we're talking about a country that had one of the worst genocides that the world has ever witnessed. So there's an issue with that. And then the other area of concern is non-penalization under Article 31, always, of the Geneva Convention. So there's a clear breach there, because the convention makes it clear that you can't be penalized purely, solely on grounds that you've entered a country irregularly. But that's exactly what the UK wants to do. Potentially, in my view, there could also be a breach if this does go ahead with the prohibition under the EU Charter in Article 19 of collective expulsions. So that's prohibited clearly, so potentially there could be that, you know, time will tell. And the others that I mentioned too, so in general, the problems in terms of procedural justice. So I've mentioned earlier the right to a fair trial, both under the ECHR and the EU Charter. Non-discrimination, again, I mentioned earlier. And in my view, potentially, there could also be a breach of the right to family life and family reunification. So this brings us then to the judgment. So I will touch upon, as I said, some, not all. First of all, I want to start by saying, why did they find it lawful? So I'll start with those, and then why they dismissed others. But for your information, these were cases of judicial review. So so the focus was on the lawfulness, irrationality, for example, whether there was any discrimination of the measure as a whole, so generally, and then specifically individual claims. So in relation to 8 applicants who had been already exposed to, well, risked being removed on the basis of these new plans. So there are two aspects, so the two sort of columns. So one, the general aspect, so the lawfulness as a whole, and then on the right, you've got the individual claims. So on that front, they've been successful. So you know, the court, the divisional court specifically, did find that the Home Office didn't consider them appropriately and they have to be reviewed. And in fact, in a moment, I'll mention the grounds on the basis of which they were given permission to appeal. This is recent, in January. But going back instead on the more general lawfulness of the scheme, it was unsuccessful. And the starting point is that there's no breach of the Geneva Convention. So I want to look at the reasoning. So what did they say? And that's something that I am quite critical about. And I was talking about it with Professor Daniele earlier during the break. The starting point is not international law. If you look at the judgment, it's reversed. So the focus is, how did the Home Secretary behave? Did she follow the specific procedures? Yes. Then we'll check the substantive aspects. So for me, i.e. human rights. So for me, that is problematic. And in particular, the court focused on whether the Home Secretary received proper assurances from Rwanda and how the Home Secretary examined these diplomatic assurances. So one first point of criticism is, well, why are these only diplomatic? You know, why are they not made enforceable or challengeable? So that is, I think, the point of criticism. Where, as I said, the judges, there were only two judges sitting here in the divisional court, you know, they were satisfied. And in fact, they even mentioned a case of the European Court of Human Rights, as if to say, you know, that automatically there's compliance with the European Convention. And then they cited another case, an English case this time, again, focusing on the duty of the Home Secretary. Did the Home Secretary follow the proper duty as established in the Tameside case? Yes. So they tick. So Suella Braverman ticks all the boxes, and so there's no breach of international human rights law. This is in a nutshell. There were other grounds examined, but I think that is what is most disconcerting. As I said, the issue of safe third country was dismissed. The court didn't find behavior of Suella Braverman to reach the level of irrationality or procedural impropriety. It's called Weddensbury irrationality, so referring to a key case, English, well, domestic level. I mentioned earlier the EU retained legislation, whether there was a breach or not, and I just wanted to mention the specific Immigration Act that has repealed all EU legislation on migration, because some of you might know that the key constitutional principle in British constitutional law is parliamentary sovereignty. So they can just repeal, as much as they've adopted, they can just repeal whatever they want. So there isn't this distinction as in civil law countries, as, you know, laws that have constitutional nature from those that don't, sort of ordinary laws. Even though, you know, now there is some initial change in that regard, but it's not enshrined in a written constitution. And so the first thing they did was, because as Professor Denier was saying, you know, since migration was very much on the political agenda for many, many years, the first thing they did is to adopt this Immigration Withdrawal Act. And so the argument there used by the court is, there's no breach of EU retained law because Schedule 1, Paragraph 6 of this Immigration Withdrawal Act has repealed all legislation, including the Asylum Procedures Directive of the first phase, of the, for those who are familiar, of the Common European Asylum System, which the EU, the UK had opted to enter in initially, then changed its mind and only decided to follow the Dublin system, but otherwise it was out of the others, the revised version. So on all fronts, on the great majority of the grounds used, it found the plan, the plan to be lawful. And so just stopping for a moment here, I wanted to go back to the position of the Law Society, because I think it really sums up what the concerns are with the plan. And also to highlight, you know, to contrast with this with what the judges said, what I explained a few minutes ago. The real concern here is what about the human rights of these individuals? They are sent 4,000 miles away. They won't be on European soil in general. And they won't be able to challenge any decision, any measure that is made, for example, by Rwandan authorities. And so there's a real problem there of access to justice, or better said, there's no access to justice. So I think the words of the president of the Law Society really are telling. You know, they really summarize very clearly what the concern is. And so the grounds that have been used to appeal against the decision, one I mentioned earlier, so again, they've included retained EU law again, but I doubt whether that might work. But from an international human rights point of view, there's reference to non-Russian 1 and Article 3 of the ECHR besides the convention of the Geneva Convention. There's reference to the systematic unfairness and related to the first ground, the fact that Rwanda is not a safe third country. And I really do find that, in fact, puzzling, how the court has completely ignored clear empirical evidence showing that Rwanda is not a safe third country. So really, I find that puzzling. And the fact, as I said, that it just based its decision, its reasoning, on the behavior of the Home Secretary, rather than looking at the reality of Rwanda and the implications for asylum claimants. And here I just wanted to pause for a moment. I don't know if you're familiar with this poem, but this is a poem by a Somali refugee. Now she has acquired British nationality, but she wrote this beautiful poem called Home. And the very first lines of this poem say that you don't leave home if home is not like the mouth of a shark. Right? And then there are other really, really very strong graphic depictions of what it means and why people are so desperate in leaving. And I wanted to link that with, you know, a graphic, again, representation of how far it is, you know, whether they're sent without, as I said, them having access to justice. And so here what is problematic, and I haven't mentioned it clear enough earlier, is that it doesn't matter that there's a connection, right? Because under international law, for a country also to be considered safe third country, one of the criteria is also a connection. Where's the connection here if they're being sent to a country so far away from where they come from? Okay, and so to conclude, I wanted to highlight the fact that sadly this is a growing trend. So the UK is not isolated, and this was also surprising for me to know that it's not the only country with which Rwanda has signed these kind of agreements. So here I've included other examples. The one from Israel is worth mentioning because here there has been already a bit of the empirical evidence and study. It's shown that in this agreement with Rwanda and Uganda, Israel has tried to summarily decide decisions against Sudanese and Eritrean asylum seekers, giving them very little choice. So the decision has been to say either you will stay detained in Israel, so giving them a false choice, right? So either you're going to be returned to your own country, so we're talking about Eritrea and Sudan, or be detained here, or you have another choice of being sent to Rwanda and Uganda. And there have been already, as I said, studies that either that doesn't happen, so they remain in long-term detention in Israel, or that they're sent back. Australia I've included mainly because, and in fact there is a debate whether that can be defined as externalization. There's a lot of debate there, but I mentioned it, if anything, because the policies of Australia have been quite influential in the UK, and they have used it, they have studied Australia's asylum policies, particularly those when years ago, they're not doing it anymore, but they were being sent to, for example, Nauru, full processing asylum applications. And as I said, they did study these offshoring procedures to see whether the same could be done in the UK. And then, sadly, we have other examples. The one that is, I think, worth mentioning is the EU-Turkey deal, because that highlights, in my view, how contradictory the European Union is, right? So, in my view, this exemplifies the problems that the common European asylum system has, besides the UK. Because on the one hand, you know, the EU likes to present itself as a global human rights actor, particularly after the entrance, of course, of the Treaty of Lisbon, you know, shared values, principles with other international organizations, reference to specific international organizations. But then on the ground, you know, we could also mention the Facilitation Directive as another, I think, embarrassing piece of legislation. My point being there is that there are two sides of the EU, right? So one trying to protect fundamental rights and the other one based very much on securitization. And the EU-Turkey deal is exactly that. And so the EU is giving a mixed message, right? So what are we doing? We're paying Turkey to keep asylum seekers out, to stop them from, if they do enter Greece, you know, to send them back to Turkey, and then Turkey will deal with it. And so there's a problem there of indirect refoulement, right? So the EU in that sense is complicit. And we know also, I mean, there's plenty of studies showing how Syrians are treated or have been treated in Turkey in the past. Besides, I mean, Greece, I mean, yes, we have also very important cases in relation to Afghan asylum seekers. You know, MSS is just, you know, one that exemplifies many problems. And so the conclusion is that you know, the UK asylum plan with Rwanda is just one of many schemes and all raise many concerns from international and European / EU human rights law. So I will stop here and give the floor to some questions, debate. So thank you very much.